Hey guys, it's Chris with just a couple notes on this episode. Originally, this was going to be another bonus episode because it was a book and the format is a little different than what we usually do. After doing it, we all kind of decided it was fine to just release as part of the regular rotation. Being that it is a little different, though, I would say that if this is your first time listening to the show, you might want to start with another episode since this is a little atypical of how this usually works. The other thing is we talk about some of the other sequels to The Giver. So if you haven't read those and you are planning on it or just don't want it spoiled, we do get into some of the details of those books. If you want to skip that stuff, it starts at about 40 minutes, and then actually right after that, Carlos spoils the end of The Sopranos. So if you don't want that spoiled either, from 40 minutes to 45 minutes, just skip that section and you'll be all good. And what else? Apparently my neighbor's home caught on fire while we were recording, so you'll hear a bunch of fire trucks and everything in the middle of this. They're fine. The house is fine. I'm not sure what happened there. A false alarm. Maybe I'd ask them about it, but they're very cold people. Maybe that's what put the fire out. Their icy disposition. I don't know. So, So there's fire trucks and then a dog's barking. It's a real amateur hour. It turns into a real shit show for a couple of minutes there. Otherwise, I think that's it. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a more traditional episode. I don't know if we've officially revealed what it is yet, but I will tell you there are Muppets involved. So look forward to that. And otherwise, enjoy the episode. Hey, do you remember The Giver? Hello, and welcome to Hey Do You Remember, a show where we reminisce about a movie or TV series we grew up with, then take off the rose-tinted glasses to see how it holds up today. I'm Chris.
I'm Donna.
And I'm Carlos.
And today we're revisiting The Giver. Eleven-year-old Jonas lives in a seemingly utopian society where pain and suffering have been all but eradicated by the sameness, a process that diminishes individuality and carefully coordinates the day-to-day life of the community's citizens. But sometimes decisions need to be made that call upon experiences this population has never endured. For that reason, one citizen has been designated the receiver of memory, someone who retains the knowledge of everything that happened before the sameness was a part of their lives. When he turns 12, Jonas learns that he has been selected to inherit this position. As the previous receiver begins to transmit his memories, Jonas grapples with an agonizing dilemma. Is this utopia worth the price they've paid to attain it? Donna, what do you remember about The Giver?
Well, I remember reading it in school. I remember it's not a movie. I feel like we didn't say that yet, but it was a book.
Oh, we're going to get to, as
I
soon as we get into the breakdown. Mm-hmm. Well, that's so accurate.
Yeah.
That's good.
It's the only form it existed in.
It was a book, and we read it in school, maybe around, third, fourth grade, something like that. And there was a boy in my class named Jonas, and his last name was Story. So this just felt like a Jonas story.
No way.
That's true. I don't know where he is. I haven't talked to him since we were like 10. But I remember. I don't remember too many details about it from being a child. I don't remember much of the story. I know we read a few Lois Lowry books, and they always seemed dramatic. And feeling evoking. And it's about all I got from my memories of the book.
So you liked the book as a kid?
I thought it was fine. It was like my favorite book or...
Just sort of.
I was like, oh yeah, I read that book. Is that what you're trying to... You know, you're still relatively new to reading. You're relatively new to everything. You're a young person. So there's so much that you haven't read that I feel like I almost felt really just consumptive about reading books and would just like swallow them and just not really retain much. But like,
well, you're supposed to read them. You don't eat them.
No. Oh, well, that's, yeah, it was tough to get that distinction. So I had a lot of trouble in the beginning.
But it's a tough lesson to learn.
It's tough. A lot of indigestion. But
how much of this did you remember? Like, the in terms of, was it the premise or just like, or the actual details of the story?
You know, the one thing that really jumped out that I really, really remembered reading when I was reading it again, I read when he's talking about receiving the memory of the Civil War was what I was like, oh, my God, I remember that. I remember, like, thinking about that. It was probably just because I had already learned something about the Civil War, and so I had some context for that. Or, you know, my imagination was already sort of lit up from my history class or whatever. So that was a part reading again that I was like, I know I've thought of this. I know this has like come in and out of my mind, this memory of all of a sudden being on a battlefield without really being there. So that I remembered very strongly. And maybe that the home for old people sort of was a thing I remembered. And being in black and white, I remember that too.
I'd forgotten most of this. But what about you, Carlos?
This was the first book assigned to a class that I actually read.
Ooh.
I usually could BS my way through most. I mean, in my entire run in school, I read this in Winesburg, Ohio, and everything else. I'm talking from like first grade through senior year of high school. Everything else was like, yeah, I can talk about anything and BS my way. I will tell you
how many movies of this podcast have you not watched?
What's Hook? Actually, when I was a junior in high school, we read Frankenstein, and I didn't read the book at all. And I was doing really well in all of the conversations in class, and then the final exam on it came, and the teacher – I was doing really well, and then the teacher said, like, the last page is just an essay question for half the points of the test, and it just says, describe in detail the ending of the book. And I look up at my teacher, and he's looking at me with a fist just like, I got you. I was like, oh.
He'd been on to you the whole time.
He'd been on to a few of us, I'm sure. But this was the first book that I ever read with a class that I read all the way through. I was really interested in this book because of the I was so into the rules. I was like, wait, how does this – you know, like I – this might have been the first book that I had ever read even a part of that wasn't set in what we know to be civilization. Mm-hmm. So it was the first book that had rules that I wasn't used to. It's like, well, how many people live in this town? How big is the town? Is the other town really far away? Are they still in the – like, I had so many questions, and my teacher was like, I don't know. Like, this – I'm sorry. I can't answer those questions for you. So I definitely remember that. I also remember just the idea of not being able to – I couldn't conceive of there being a lack of color because, you know, even gray is another color. So to me, I was like, what are they seeing?
Yeah.
Like, are they seeing grays? Do they see – are there different color people?
Exactly.
So like the whole – I mean, I would assume no, that there aren't. But does that mean that there are – black people with white skin? Like, it just, like, the whole thing was just mind-boggling to me. And we definitely read this in sixth grade. So there was that. Definitely some, like, hey, I'm going through puberty, and this is, like, mildly evocative of some things that I might be also going through at the same time. And what else did I, was I, like, really, I mean, I remembered almost all of the book when I went to read it again, except for the parts, the ending. My interpretation of the ending is completely different now than when
I was a kid. Totally.
And I didn't remember what releasing ended up meaning. So, yeah, I didn't remember that. I was like, oh, no. It was a big twist for me when I read it again.
Yeah.
But it, and I, oh, and I also remembered this book being really long and really hard to get through.
Well, when it's the only book you've ever read.
It's the only full book I've ever read. I mean, everything else at that point had been like storybooks that were like Dr. Seuss or like Disney had some giant art books. This was the first like, yeah, like novel that I actually ever read. And yeah, I definitely remember this was like a big long book. And I think I read this book in a combined like maybe hour and 45 minutes this time around. So yeah, that I remembered a lot of it, but there were some things that I don't think I was mature enough yet to have interpreted or at least to have internalized, I guess.
Okay. Before I share my memories of this, I need to know, did you attempt to BS the ending of Frankenstein?
Oh, yeah, I did. I wrote this really long ending. And I thought like it was kind of relatively close. And then in the middle of that, when he sees that I'm writing, he goes, if you're guessing, you'll get deducted more points. And so, I mean, I wish I had saved the paper because it's like this really long paragraph that I'm writing. And then I just made like a perforated edge line in the middle. And then I said, or... I don't know.
Pick one.
Pick one. I got a C minus in that English class. It was it was a very low grade for me in English. But I learned more in that class than in any other class that I took that I had in high school. Except for maybe film class, because that's when I found out that I liked movies.
Okay, so for me, my memories of The Giver, I remember what I remembered when you first suggested it. First thing that popped to my mind was the image of the cover with sad ZZ Top.
And sad ZZ Top.
Sad Tuck.
And that gold seal, you know, Newbery Award winning novel. I read this in third grade. We were supposed to turn it in when we were done. I did not. So my copy still had the words Mrs. Olenek, room 304 on the inside cover.
Oh, man.
I don't think I kept it because I was in love with it. Like, I think I definitely did that with other books, like in high school and stuff. I think this was more a case of just like, I don't want to walk to the front of the room. I think that's how I wound up with it. Chris, you read The Giver. Now it's time to give her it back. Hang on to it.
I'm the receiver.
Yeah, exactly. I think I liked it. I'm pretty sure. I did. I don't remember that. I didn't remember that much of it before we had done this. Like you guys talking about release and all of that was like I was experiencing for the first time. I had retained none of that stuff. I think it's – so you read it – what grade were you in when you read this?
I want to say fourth or fifth. I'm not really sure, though.
And you read it in sixth grade?
Definitely in sixth grade.
See, I think third grade was too young to read this.
I think it's
and,
way too
and
young
And
to
not
read
because
this
it's like you can't comprehend it, although I do think a lot of it goes over your head. But I think Jonas, 12 years old in the book, I think you have to be around that age because it's so tied into things you're probably already going through, like figuring out your own identity and all this other stuff. It's so tied into that I don't think I could have appreciated it as a third grader. I think just, thematically, it probably works better when you're his age. And I think that's basically it. This is like a rare, super brief intro for me because I just that most of this was I had forgotten.
This is the rare time you didn't read the novelization of it before.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's only ever been a novelization.
I went into this one pretty blind. So with that said, we just looked at it with fresh eyes. So let's see how The Giver holds up. Okay, so obviously this is going to be a little different than most of our episodes because we're not going to walk you through each chapter. We would be here all night. I've got some talking points. They started out in a vaguely chronological order. I'm not really sure that's the case anymore. But even still, feel free to jump around the book, as much as you'd like here. This is going to be more like a book club meeting than like a super detailed analysis of the plot. So we're not really sure how this is going to go. We haven't done something like this before. It's kind of a exciting and scary experiment. Mm-hmm. If it's awful, we promise we'll never do it again. And if it isn't,
we'll do more of them.
Maybe.
I didn't read other books.
Then we knew all along it would be a giant hit. So, but I would recommend reading this book again if you can before you listen to this. You don't have to. I realize most people probably won't, but seriously, you can finish it in a few hours. So the first thing I thought we could discuss is like the setup of the story, because the first chunk of the novel is all – it's introducing us to this society and how it all works. So I thought we could talk about like the society itself, the setting of the book, all the rules, and just the way that she introduces us to all this stuff, which I think is pretty clever.
I do.
I think like what I liked most about it, because again, I was going in this with kind of a clean slate, was the way – you're introduced to this world is sort of, it's almost like downright pleasant the way it's described at first. Everybody gets along and it seems very jovial. And it's only as the, you know, things, you're, it slowly reveals like that something is amiss here, that something isn't quite right. It starts to become less and less recognizable as our own world and something that's completely different. And I was like really shocked by, I remember there obviously being some degree of control over this population, the extent of which I had totally forgotten, like down to his family not really being his family. I had not remembered that at all.
That is wild. I didn't remember any of that. No. Mm-mm.
Like the – so yeah. Like your – his – what is it? There's like 50 kids that are born every year.
Right.
And then at a certain age, you're placed with like a mother and father unit.
After your first year.
First year. And yeah, so his sister's not his sister. Mom's not mom. Dad's not dad. There's no real like, I mean, I don't even know at what point it becomes clear that there's no love here. There's no real affection. It's just like.
Yeah, it's just tell us your dreams. Mm-hmm. And. Tell us how you felt about that. Tell us about your day. But it's never like, you know, there's never any like hugging or, all right, good night, you know, like nothing like that.
But what's great, the way she does it is so great because you have the family sitting around the dinner table and it's just like, okay, let's talk about our feelings. And you go like, that's a little eh. Mm-hmm. But it's like the dinner table setting, this is a very normal thing. It isn't until later, I think after he's already started seeing the giver that you realize mom and dad aren't really mom and dad, right?
Mm, yeah. At first, I feel like it seems, when you first start reading the book, it seems like a utopia. Like everything is very convenient and very congenial. Everything makes sense. Everyone is polite to one another. There, you know, everyone has a good education. Everyone has enough to eat. Those are the things I feel like that you notice first. You're given this lovely picture of, oh, it's so great. And we talk about exactly what goes on in our heads, and I can help you interpret that. And it's just very convenient. And it's this lovely, simple way of life that I feel like she almost dangles that to say, oh, wouldn't this be, isn't this sort of appealing?
You right.
Know? So you can see later how, you know, I mean, it really makes you think because you hear something, it's too good to be true. Well, it is.
I think the first time you notice, to me, the first chink in the armor is when they start talking about how what they did to kids who didn't choose the right words. Like if you said, right. I'm starving, they're like, no, you're not starving. You're hungry. Right. And if you said it again, they hit you with like a rubber stick.
Yeah.
And I remember going, okay, I get that. Like, you know, you want to correct this now because they're very focused on keeping their emotions, you know, an inventory of what they're going through. But then when they said, there's a moment later when they say that they use the same stick on the old people in the house of the old. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, like that's effed up because these are people who've put in their time.
Mm.
That was, I think, the first chinks in the armor for me was like, okay, like you're being punished if you're not absolutely conforming to this.
The precision of language stuff I thought was really interesting. And there's the part where his friend Asher, he's asking for a snack, but he says, I want a smack.
Smack.
And he does it repeatedly day after day after day. He just can't get it out, despite the fact that he is smacked with a stick because you asked for this, so that's what you're going to get. Like right.
The point where this happens to Asher, they're like 3 or 4 years old right. when this happens. This is right when you're starting to talk. So right. it's not like a 7 year old or even
right.
not that that's okay then to punish someone that way, but that's right at the beginning. That's,
yeah. I mean, that's just the idea of like say what you mean. Like, there's no room for, you know, like flowery, like, or it's, and you know, now we live in a world of hyperbole and where, yeah. you know, we don't even, no one understands what the word literally means anymore. Like, people today,
literally, no one knows what literally means.
That, I mean, we'd be in real trouble. But so, yeah, that stuff I thought was really interesting. The, I think, the moment that really surprised me maybe the most, because by the time we get to the idea of like the twist of what the release actually is, I think by that point I was bracing for something. Like there was going to be a turn coming pretty quickly. I just sensed that's where the story was going. The thing that really surprised me was the lack of color. When it's revealed that like, oh, that the thing with the apple, your friend's hair, that's you're seeing the color red. That's red. That's color.
Right.
And just realizing like, oh shit, this whole time like yeah. you can't there mm-hmm. And what you said is interesting. Like you imagine this world in black and white,
yeah.
which is then retroactively like what I started to do and what I'm assuming you did too, because like you said, the concept of no color, you can't wrap your mind around. Like is that because, like, again, gray is a color.
Right. And black is a color.
And yeah. Exactly what you were saying about, like, if this society is all about not acknowledging differences, we don't point out something that's unusual on somebody. We don't call attention to that. The idea of no color has something to do with different races. We don't see race anymore.
Like, my brain compromised and said, it has to be all white people. Because there are differences between races, and you would notice the differences, even if, you know, they were exactly the same shade of skin, there are still going to be physical differences between a black person and a white person,
yeah.
or an Asian person and a Hispanic person. Actually, Asians and Hispanics have the same DNA, but an Asian person and a white person, whatever. There are going to be differences there. So either everyone has been genetically over time made into tomorrow people, as we were right. saying earlier, we're all basically one mixed race that
just
is all the same shade
of everything.
Yeah, we'd have to be all the same shade of gray or white, because yeah. again, they don't have any other colors. Mm-hmm. So,
well, that's an interesting. I wonder when you guys thought when you started reading it, what time period did you think you were in? Like, is this in the future? Is this present day?
I think I assumed future just because of the nature of the memories he was receiving seemed more in line with like a contemporary, obviously not the war stuff, but I mean, just in general, it seemed like it was sort of an evolution of our society versus like, I don't know. I mean, I know one thing that did occur to me when I was reading this again was remembering that the first time I had read this in third grade, I definitely pictured this society the same way that they do. There's an episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation where they go to like a utopian society that turns out not to be all it's cracked up to be.
Oh,
go figure.
Never heard that story before.
So, and they're just the architecture of that planet, the way they're dressed, which was ridiculous. That's how I imagined The Giver the first time I had read it. So in my mind, it was always like future, like in the future. But
I always thought really futuristic as well, like in the future so far and in like also a vacuum pocket off to the side of the world. Like it just seems so far removed, you know.
Well, the questions you were asking, Carlos, are the same ones that were occurring to me this time as I first started, of just like, where is this community in relation to other communities? Is this, is how vast has this sameness thing gone? Is it concentrated to this one area, or is this something that we've all sort of conformed to everywhere? Just like all that stuff, just how all of that worked.
I feel like I should mention, I don't even know if you guys know, but this is actually one in a quartet of books.
I was going to bring that up later, but yeah.
So I never read the other ones. So this one, to me, it's the first in the series, and it's self-contained for me, because I think that I kind of think Lois Lowry kind of sold out a little bit when she made the future ones, and they changes the interpretation, I think, that is intended at the beginning, at the end of this book.
Mm-hmm.
I ask those questions too. Like, is it just this community that has sameness? Are there other communities that are like they want to, you know, maybe they're warlike or whatever. I also picture this to be in the future, but in a simplistic future, if that makes sense. Like, there's obviously the technology to ship cargo, and I think there's a plane in like the first paragraph.
Yeah.
There's a plane. So you know that you're at least near the present, but they wear tunics. So I guess what I'm kind of picturing might be something close to like the Bill and Ted future, maybe without all, you know, obviously without the sparkly colors, but everyone just kind of wearing like simpler or you know what, the future from Demolition Man would kind of be what I'm picturing. Like, everything's just kind of like antiseptic.
I get that too. I was picturing everything very flat, very simple. Yeah, exactly what you said. Very sterile.
Yeah.
Before we get too far along, the other things I wanted to mention about the issue of color was the thing about like the different skin tones and how everybody must be white. Like that makes a lot of sense. But also but just the differences between like people's hair color, like, you know, like even though you can't see the color red, I mean, that looks different than somebody with dark brown.
Yeah, it photographs differently.
Hair. And so, I mean, I don't know if I'm getting, cause a lot of, this is something I wanted to talk about later too, is just sort of like the things that are left very vague and then the specificity of other things, like they allude to genetic engineering, but then how exactly the sameness works is never really addressed.
You have to take two big leaps with this, and it's the sameness and the ability of a giver to pass memories on through touch.
Yeah.
And those are the two that you have to, to someone who is also a receiver. Like, it can't just be passed on to anyone.
Well, and the fact that he is holding all these memories, experience.
The idea of a giver or a receiver, I guess.
It's like basically an external hard drive of like, and now here's my USB cord.
He's
and I'm
Google
gonna, yeah,
person.
And I'll pass this on to you.
Maybe that's his name. Maybe his name is Google.
Google giver.
But so I'm wondering, you know, as we debate the specifics of like, what, no color, da da da, if Lois Lowry would just be like, guys, it's just take it for what it is. And
well, I feel like, because Lois Lowry also wrote Number of the Stars, which is about the Holocaust. So I feel like there is some element in here of that. Clearly, that's a subject that's near and dear to her heart, or is very important to her. So I feel like there is an element of that, that Hitler-y move of like, everyone has to be the same. There's a touch of that. What always happens when someone has a great idea like that for, you know, Tomorrowland. But it's really very disturbing. Like, and that to me is this sort of a shadow of that experience without being the same, but it's the same.
Well,
does
I think
that makes
sense? No, it makes sense. Yeah. What I think is interesting to contrast there is that on the one hand, you've got something that is definitively very evil, you know, the Holocaust and how that all happened and Hitler and his motivations. Mm-hmm. That's something you can look at and go like, yeah, that was bad.
Clearly
you shouldn't have done that.
Not a good moment in human history.
But this, what's interesting is that it is disturbing, but it's not really evil because it's not that these are bad people. It's that they don't know any better. Like some of the horrific things that Jonas finds out about, there's also this understanding that it's like they're not being cruel. They just don't have the emotion or the experience to understand that this is what they're doing is terrible.
Mm-hmm. And it could be very – I mean, it seems like the language in the book, you know, suggests that people got so sick of – war and evil that they just said, let's get rid of all of that. And I mean, they might all be white people in this village because they might have just said, you know what, mixing races is creating wars because there's a difference there. Maybe we should just break up, you know, like mm-hmm. break apart. Mm. So there might be a community of different races all over. And yeah, I do think it's the same goal that Hitler had, but for at least a good, you know, without murdering anyone, probably.
Well, no.
I mean, without murdering, okay, sorry. They definitely murder people. Without murdering an entire race of people just because they were different. That is never explicitly stated, although it might have happened. We don't know.
Yeah, see, in my mind, that's sort of where we got to. This is the aftermath. This would have been, what the ultimate goal would have been, you know? If he had succeeded.
Except for Fiona's darn red hair.
Darn red hair.
I love how, because the book is about, early themes or, being very, exact with your language, the fact that he doesn't know what he's seeing, we don't ever get clear language on it until it's labeled.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
He can't explain it, so she can't explain it.
Exactly. And we're going to get into this later. I want to save a discussion. Obviously, there's a movie version that's in production right now. We're going to talk about that later. But this is just one of the things that, I was really impressed that for a book that's written for kids, this really takes advantage of being a book in a way that you don't see a lot. This is something that cannot exist in this way, like any other way than being a book. You can't do – they're going to have to change – they're going to have to take a lot of license when they do the movie because it works on the page in an entirely different way.
That was part of the reason why I pushed to have this to have this now was before we start seeing images of what this movie's going to look like. I didn't want to read the book and be thinking about Jeff Bridges.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
Because I wanted to think about the guy in the cover, who I clearly labeled the giver, even though, the book doesn't explicitly state that that's the man.
No, that's exactly.
What do you guys think about how many people live in this town?
Yeah.
How many people must live in the community? Because it's not a huge town.
Right.
If there's only 50 kids per age per year, then, if, let's say, people live to 50, then there's only 2,500 people in the entire town.
Yeah.
So it's not a huge community.
Yeah.
Which, again, once I did the math on that, totally changed the way I thought about the community. Yeah. It's this is nowhere near a city. This is like a village.
Right, exactly.
At first, when I thought about it, I was picturing the community at 500 people.
Okay.
Real small. And then
same here.
They start talking about, if you go out to be a farmer. And it's farmers, yeah, maybe there's people sort of on the outskirts of the community really making the wheels turn. And the people who are assigned to fly planes or drive trucks or whatever. So then I was maybe a couple thousand.
They never say how old elderly people are in this. They might be they might be 45 years old. Yeah, we have no idea.
Yeah.
They have trouble getting in and out of the tubs and they're our age. My bones.
I mean, I'm sore when I get home from work, so I can only imagine.
I wake up and I'm like, ow.
I'm gonna admit something.
A stretch.
So you said that this this book tied into you were going through puberty and there was maybe some
I was in sixth grade.
So, right. Yeah. So I was obviously much younger, and in third grade, just reading the word naked would be like, that's forbidden. that's scandalous. And so even this is
– this is why I'm shocked that you guys read it in third and fourth grade. No way.
Yeah.
They wouldn't – no.
So even something like him bathing the old woman, I was like – you mean she's naked? He's in the room with a naked person. And I was just I just fixated on that. And it's like the Harry and the Hendersons hot tub scene. It's Chris, it really didn't take much, did it?
That was that age when you were looking up dirty words in dictionaries?
Yeah.
Penis.
Oh.
Exactly. Think it moved.
I think, for me, when you bring something like that up, that was the big difference between books and movies for me when I was a kid, because there was never any regulation on what I could read. My parents would not censor books at all. If I picked something up and wanted to read it, good luck, read it.
Yeah.
If you have questions, I guess we can talk about it. But I was never censored, never censored with reading. But I was so strict with movies, with the ratings, and, you can't see a PG-13 movie until you're 13, as it is stated on the rating. So I was so slow in that respect. But in this, when you guys are saying that, I'm like, oh, I read the word naked tons of times before I read this book. I don't know. I mean, not that I was reading, like, filth or anything. Horn but yeah, I could easily.
I don't lie. You know.
I was reading smut in second grade.
Mm-hmm. Well, we...
That's the point of that story.
No, that's so crazy. That's such mm-hmm. a good point, because my parents were exactly the same way. Like, mm-hmm. I very, very into what I was watching, but not so much about, like... And not even just, like, a kind of an ignorance to the books I was reading. Like, I was in... I've mentioned before, I started reading, like, Stephen King and stuff when I was in fifth grade. Mm-hmm. I was reading my mom's books. Like, my mom... Like, Mom, can I have your copy of The Shining? Can I... Oh, sure. I mean, so she knew what I was... What I would the kind of stuff I was reading, and there were and yeah, Dean Koontz, Stephen King, these things were loaded with sex scenes. I remember going into like a Walgreens or some other kind of drugstore like that and picking out a book just because the cover had these three dead girls coming out of a lake and their eyes were glowing and had this really cool effect on the cover, and I was like, I want that. And my aunt was like, I don't know, and my dad was like, it's fine.
Yeah.
And that book I thought was going to be about like these three ghosts of like dead girls that come back to avenge my murder.
By having sex with the whole town.
No, the whole book is pretty much just like woman moves back to this town with her son and like and just fucks like it's her job. The whole book is her just like humpy-humpying. And then there's like tons of violence. There's like her abusive father who had like molested her. And it was the first time the concept of incest was introduced to you. I'm in fifth grade.
Wow.
And just it gets very descriptive about how he like messes himself and is just like and drooling. And I was like, what is this? I remember the first time the word fucking appears in the book in regards to like being a sexual thing, I just stared at the word forever, like, fucking. Huh. They were fucking. And because the line, it's like some guy says something about, like, you know, when we made love, and she's like, is that what you call it? Because I call it fucking. And I was like, so it's not making, it's fucking. Just really like taking this in.
Oh,
fucking.
Boy.
So that one did a number on me. But anyways.
I read the books that were tied to the TV series Ghostwriter on PBS.
Oh my gosh.
That's what
WRiter.
Not Nicolas Cage on a motorcycle with a plank of skull.
Ghostwriter, yeah.
Yeah, those are the books that I read.
Show.
It was a great show. It really was. Mm. Those are the books that I read. And like the Beverly Cleary.
Oh,
yeah,
Ramona and like Mouse and the Motor.
Dear Mr. Crenshaw, was that was a thing, right? I read that one. It was like all written. The whole book is written as letters to a writer.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
I remember that.
Yeah, I don't remember anything about them, but I know I read them.
Yeah,
Stuart Little. I mean, those are the books I read as a kid because I was.
Those are quality books.
Those are quality.
Nothing wrong with those books.
Nothing wrong with those books.
I read those books. Those are good.
None of them involve.
You're certainly not going to read. Fucking.
Nope.
Steer clear of that.
There was no who would you be, who would you have section at the end of those books.
No.
Nope.
All
there
right.
There should have been.
Oh, no.
The Giver.
So, I mean, I guess we can just talk about the ending. Because I'm guessing when you say you had a different read on it as an adult... I'm guessing as a kid, you thought it was a little more optimistic.
As a kid, I'm like, oh, he made it to the town. And I used to hate the enigmatic, he heard music in the distance, but perhaps it was just an echo. I was like, okay, does that mean that they're playing music in his town too? Like, oh, music made it. Yay. As an adult, not so much. As an adult, I'm like, oh, he found a hill and it's covered in snow and he found the same sled he remembers. And he's holding this baby, and they haven't eaten sufficiently in days, and they're sliding down the hill, and he can see the thing in the distance, and it's a town, and it's like a Christmassy kind of town,
yeah.
Which is also another happy memory he had, and he can hear music in the distance where he's going, but perhaps it was just an echo he was just remembering. I was like, oh, they died. They died out there. I mean, and in their dying, the memories will all be released, which is nice, but that's horrible. Like, I was like, that is not, the ending I wanted, you know, for this, because that's not the ending I remembered, actually. You know, I was like, oh, what a coincidence. He found a sled. He knows what to do with it because he has those memories, see?
Mm. What about you?
I think that they did.
They made it.
They did. They
I thought you said they did, as in they did. They made it to that town. Yeah, they did.
No, I say you, he did.
Yeah.
I think they're super dead.
Super dead.
Reading it again, I really think that that is what I thought when I was a child, too. I feel like I thought, oh, that's the tunnel with the white light. That's them going up to heaven or whatever. I really thought, I thought then that they were dying. And I definitely think that now. It's like, oh, no. And it's amazing. I like that the book takes them out of the situation. I like that he escapes and is trying so hard. And I like that he takes Gabriel with him. And at the end of it, I just think it's not enough. There's just no place for him. They're just...
Yeah.
They just released themselves in their own way instead of a shot in the arm without ever seeing anything else. So,
because the goal was not to die. The goal was to get to the next village. Because if you got far enough away from your community, then the memories would all come rushing back to them and they wouldn't be able to handle it. So that's why the giver stayed back.
Right.
Things would change.
Things would change. Yeah, they would be like, they would suddenly understand all of these things. They would see colors. Everything would be back to normal. Back to our normal for them. And so he's getting away and you're like, okay, he's still holding on to these memories. So they haven't gone away yet. Because when he gives them to Gabriel, he doesn't remember them anymore.
Right.
So they haven't gone back to the community yet. He hasn't gotten quite far enough. Mm. So really, I mean, the only two outcomes are he's going to die or he's going to find a new village. Mm. And yeah, he doesn't find a new village. He doesn't, at least in my reading of the book, he doesn't find a new village. Yeah. Christopher?
Well, I don't even remember there being a discussion about does he live, does he die when we read this as kids, and obviously I really don't remember any of it, so we very well could have, but I feel like the book would have stuck with me more if there had even been a question, him dying was even an option. I think I would have I would have remembered that, I think. So I'm not sure that had even occurred to me. To me, it was even beyond what you were saying. The fact that he finds the sled in the hill from his memory, I thought, like, well, this isn't real. And
right.
And the hill, a hill. And it's like, I just thought, nah, it's not there. And the fact that, like, all of it just started to feel like they're dead. They freeze to death. But I do think there are arguments to support both outcomes. And so...
there's one big argument to support both outcomes.
Well, on the they survive side, the fact that, like you said, he no longer has those memories anymore. So what he's seeing must be real, that this can't be a memory of the sled and the hill and that stuff. It's got to be that this is actually there. On the dying side, it's, you know, what I said about the convenience of a sled that's exactly as the giver described it.
And it was buried in the snow. Like, he found it. It wasn't just, like, laying out there. He knew where it was.
Yeah.
Because of
he recognized,
yeah.
Right. A community, I guess, not governed by the sameness that's so close to his own would be a little strange. The fact that we don't know exactly how far he's traveled, but if it's to the point where search planes or whatever aren't looking for him anymore.
Stopped, right.
I don't know, but I guess that also goes back to we don't know exactly how that works, if it's how many communities are doing the same thing or whatever.
As a kid, I definitely just took it at, like, face value. Oh, there's another town, and he's going to make it because he's going downhill. And that's a weird line about music being an echo and being in the future. And that was that. Like, none of the other kids in my class understood that line. The teacher wasn't, like, helping us understand it. Like, maybe that was her intention.
Well, there
was
also,
like, not to help us understand it.
I think, you know, the implication that, like, one of you mentioned this already, that maybe it's back in his town with all the new memories. Like, oh, music. We've discovered music again.
Right.
So the plan worked. Or maybe that's just, like, maybe that's just – but he's so far away that, like, maybe that's just what he needed before.
Yeah. Yeah.
Going forward. Yeah.
And well, the other big argument as to what happened at the end of this book. So we all interpreted generally the same way. They die. One of the other sequels of this book, Jonas exists. He lives. He's an adult.
And two out of the three, I think Jonas is, or maybe he's
they
in all
mention
three.
Him. They mention him in the second one. He's a character in the third
That's
one.
That's right.
And then the fourth one came out, and I don't know anything about the fourth
yeah,
one.
Yeah, I just read the Wikipedia summaries of them.
Me too. So. I do it from time to time. It's like, oh yeah, how did that turn out?
Well, just getting ready for this, I was like, because of the ending, specifically the ambiguous ending, I was like, well, how does she deal with this in the subsequent books? And before I read the summaries, I thought for sure they were just going to be stories that took place in the same mm-hmm. world and maybe reference the events of The Giver, but never not disrupt the ambiguity of the ending and just right. not. But nope. Jonas and Gabriel definitively very alive.
They made it, and there's no other talk of the community, that first community,
which is a real bummer.
It's like, well, I don't care about this new community. I don't know what happened to the old community.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that would be the definitive answer. They live. Which,
well, as of 2000, right. whenever she which wrote is the first sequel.
It's actually a similar argument I had with buddies really? when The Sopranos ended. Because my interpretation of the ending of The Sopranos was that Tony dies. Spoilers, but it's not really because it's ambiguous.
No. There's got to be – we're pat the spoiler bullshit
yeah,
and something
that,
that'll –
that
no, no.
show ended in 2008, I
yeah,
believe.
We got, yeah, sometimes you got to talk about things. Yeah. Just deal with it.
So – my interpretation of the ending of Sopranos is that Tony died, and I had, you know, extensive proof to back that theory up. And my buddies and I had a bet, and it was if they – because they would always talk about this Sopranos movie. If they come up with a Sopranos movie and Tony's alive after the events of the show, I had to buy them, I think, a burger or something like that, or pizza.
So high stakes is what you're
real,
saying.
Yeah, we never make bets higher than that. Serious? Yeah, it's pretty much Pequod's Pizza or Kuma's Burgers. That's it.
Oh, that yeah. does sound good. Yeah.
Right? Both of them together at last. but you know, obviously James Gandolfini has since passed, so I win the bet by default. But I always made the argument. Yeah.
So you were the one guy that was like, shit.
Yes! But I always made the argument with them. Was like, no, it doesn't matter what the movie will, you know, whatever happens in the movie. When they made this show, that was their intent.
Exactly.
Was this. And I think for The Giver, that was the same thing. When she wrote this book, that was the intention of the ending of the book.
That's what I was going to say, was that everything that I read about it was that it seemed like at the time, this is what she wanted, was you take it however you're going to take it. She, in her mind, I think, had made up her mind that they survived. But she was allowing for the possibility for, you know, it's not definitive on purpose. It's not right. like.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So then I guess like the last, well, not the second to last thing I want to talk about is just some of the themes in the book. Obviously, the big one is the importance and the value of memory, learning from past mistakes. That's what they make the most of in the book, is that we need to call upon these experiences in order to – sometimes we're – you know, something happens and we're not sure how to proceed. So then you go to the receiver and say, hey, what do we do? Considering all these variables, what do we do here? And he can advise. What I thought of later in terms of like the importance of memory and stuff is that when he gets the memory of like the Christmas and the family is all around, the grandparents, the parents, and feeling all that love and all that stuff, and the idea of like a legacy is something that doesn't exist in this community. And more importantly, the way that like it's not just our own memories. It's the fact that my grandpa told stories about his time in the war to my dad. And those aren't my dad's memories, but my dad can tell them to me. And then I can tell them to, right. you know, my son or daughter someday. And in that way, like that's my, you know, my grandpa still exists through those stories. In this community, when you're gone, there is nothing left of you. That's really disturbing.
It's not even when you're gone. Once your kids are of age and they move out of your house, you get moved off to the home for childless adults.
Right. And then you exist there until you're ready to be released. But then at the point that you're released, you may as well have never been there.
Right.
Like, that's just – man, that's like
– yeah.
That's scary. That's really freaky when you think about it that way.
Because, yeah, the whole idea of passing on, you know, like of procreating is kind of to achieve immortality, right? Like you're passing your genetic, you know, code.
The bloodline goes on.
Yeah, onto a new generation and so on and so forth. That's how all creatures on Earth exist, you know. Some creatures only exist to pass on their genes. But in this one, you don't even have your own kids. Your kids are assigned to you at, you know, particular after you've been married for, I think, 5 years, you can apply for a child or something like that. Mm. And they're assigned to you. They might be, I mean, well, they're not going to be related to you, but, you know, the kids that you get might be related. They might not be because there's only a set number of, like, birth mothers who only birth kids for like 3 or 4 years and then they go on to do menial tasks for the rest of their lives. Like it's, yeah. And the idea that being a birth mother, which is, you know, the most basic human, you know, function is considered like a shit job in this, in this society. Like, you know, giving life to people is like, oh, you don't want to be a birth mother. Like, don't ever say that you want to be a birth mother. Because that's the lowest of the low, basically. It's crazy.
Yeah. It is really weird. Sorry. I love what you said about passing on, you know, your own. Not only do you pass on, you know, your genetic material, but also your experiences, your family's experience for years on. And even if, say, you were adopted into a family, but they're still going to tell you, you know, all those life experiences. We're sort of all receivers and givers in that way. And, yeah, to not have that, to not have those stories of humanity, of how we got where we are, I would be lost without that. I have no, you know.
Well, it's so much of your identity you know, where you came from. And I never met my dad's grandparents, but I feel like I know them. I've seen photos of them. I've heard his stories about them. Those are real people to me, even though they were dead, you know, before I was born.
Yeah, right. Thank God. You need those people with you.
Well, and then, I mean, you know, the similar idea there that the book touches on is the idea of, like, pain and pleasure, that you can't really know one without the other, that to experience true happiness, you also have to know what loss feels like. I mean, in order to, like, that's part of loving something is having to lose it. And, you know, like the whole thing about releasing, if I'm sure everybody has figured it out by this point, they're actually killing people.
They're euthanizing people.
Right. Yeah. So like when Jonas sees the video of his father euthanizing a baby too, that's the thing too, is like the craziest way to show you like what they're doing. I mean, that's for a kid's book. It's so ballsy.
Yeah.
But to not understand the gravity of what's taking place, because his father has never really loved anything, to know that like you're losing something when this happens.
Yeah.
That I thought that, you know, it did a really good job of making you think about all that too, and just sort of going like, I mean, and this is something that as adults, you know, we've come to understand, you know, time and time again, that things are up and then they're down, and the good times are better when you've had bad times, to go like, well, thank Christ it's not that.
And do you remember why he euthanized the baby? Do you remember what it was?
Because it weighed less than the other one.
It was a twin that weighed less than the other one. So they weighed them, and it was like a gram or something. Like it was like off by one small amount, and they're like, oh, got to kill this one. But they didn't say kill. They said release.
Right.
Yeah.
And they paint a lovely picture when they talk about the release before you really know what it is. It's very lovely.
Well, it's a celebration for the...
Yes. And you imagine old people wandering into a field. So
I thought
free. That
also sounded very harrowing. Like, just, the release are just, good luck.
That is a little tricky, but maybe there's some pancakes on the other side or something. No, there are no pancakes.
I don't remember pancakes.
It is terrible.
Thanks, Charles Barkley. It's terrible. It is also the idea that if you don't have your past experiences, you, as a society, you can't ever move forward. So.
Sorry, apparently half the neighborhood's burning down. If this ends abruptly, it's because we're on fire and we've been released.
I live by a firehouse. I didn't even notice that.
Oh, really?
I live about a block away from a fire department.
Looking it up.
When I was in college, I lived right by some train tracks, and when I came home and it was totally quiet in the suburbs. I couldn't sleep without the train.
I get that.
Yeah. But so the point that I was making before the fire department so rudely interrupted me was that if you don't have past experiences as a society, you can't ever move forward because you're not working off of anything.
No.
And especially when that society tries to hold down any differences or any new thoughts, you can't ever move forward, you know, the way we've moved forward in the last, say, 100 years. You know, like that would never happen in this society. So this society has probably been essentially the very same for, you know, back and back and back, as they say in the book, as many generations as it, you know, as Lois Lowry, you know, imagined.
Yeah.
They're never going to move forward, ever.
Yeah.
Well, and then there's also the issue of choice and, like, you know, the fact that it's sort of like what you're left feeling like, well, what is the point of actually living in this community? Like, yes, they're very safe and protected and everything. But what is the point if you are not making choices? If it's just go here, do this, this is how, like, that, you know, that also starts to.
And it's not like an evil, you know, tyrant is controlling them. Mm-mm. Nobody has choice.
Right.
Even the elders don't really have choice. They're every bit as wise as everyone else. They just happen to have lived a little bit longer.
Mm.
They don't have any other worldly wisdom.
You know, the thing that this made me think about is, so, you know, obviously we want to be free, but you do need some degree of control.
Sure.
So I think part of what makes the story so successful is that you, not that things could potentially get, you know, this to this exaggerated a level, it could, you know, this bad, but like the seeds of this sort of idea are already here. We do take medication not to feel things.
Yes.
And there are a list of rules we follow unconditionally. We don't even that aren't, you know, rigidly enforced. I mean, you probably stopped at every red light on the way here. I mean, it's just what we do.
That's the social contract.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. But like, this always makes me think of this issue versus like choice versus control and all that. It makes me think of the Grand Theft Auto games, and not specifically those, but I think open world games in general, sandbox games, because I think we want to be free, but I think really what we're interested in is as long as we have the illusion that we're making choices, I think we're okay with that. Because those games are all about, you know, they make you feel like you can go anywhere, you can do anything, the whole world is open to you. But it's on rails. You're still having a controlled experience. Yes. They're just disguising it really well. Yeah. And I think our lives are like that a lot of the times too, where we just sort of, as long as I feel like I'm in control, as long as I feel like I had a choice, then I'm okay. And the amount of stuff we surrender as long as we have that is pretty alarming. And it's another reason that when you think about a story like this, you kind of go like, well, yeah, maybe, I don't know, someday, I don't know. I mean, not really, but, you know.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. We do take medications that suppress feelings and make us less passionate. I don't know if you've ever spoken to anyone who is on, like, heavy antidepressants. Zombies.
Sure.
You know, like,
sure.
Yeah, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that there is a lot of truth in that, in what we live in now. I also thought there was an interesting point in the book where Jonas is given the list of rules that are allowable, like, things he's allowed to do and not do for his job. And the last one is, you can lie.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, I think he doesn't tell that many lies early on. I think the first lie is that he doesn't take his don't go through puberty pills.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that suppress the stirrings, I believe.
The stirrings,
But when he starts to question, wait, who else is allowed to lie?
Right.
And he could never know the answer because if he asked them, they could just say no.
Right.
It's, I mean, that's the two rules that went hand in hand. You can ask any question you want and you can lie. Which immediately put doubt into him for the whole rest of the society.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, you know, my parents could be totally lying to me all the time, and they're totally allowed, and I have no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That was one of my favorite parts, and I had forgotten to make note of that.
As did I until right now.
Okay, well, then the last thing I do want to talk about then is the movie. And sort of like... Well, I guess maybe before we get into what's actually happening, I mean, I don't know if you guys have thoughts on how you would do this. And if you were making the film, if there are any changes you would make to the story or anything like that, or just how you would approach this.
Why are you looking at me? I'm the only one who didn't go to film school.
I always go to you first. Because you're a lady.
Oh, that's real nice.
Thank you.
Fucking steals my ideas after that.
I would do what Donna did.
Oh, treachery. If I were making this movie, it would be in black and white, and it would be very futuristic. I think almost like a Star Trek-y look to the costumes, like almost an Asian blank gray suits, tunics. It would be, if I was making it, it would be very low budget.
Like if you, Donna Ray, got the rights to the movie right now, yeah, it would be made for like $16.
Got a couple bucks.
The community is your apartment. There are two residents.
The bedroom is one house.
Oh, Jonas, I think you're nice too. Meet me after school. Yeah, I think I would try to stay as close to the book as possible, and they would for sure die if this was my film. I don't have a lot of experience with this, but I think the look of it, I've seen a couple of the two pictures that are released of what it's going to be, and I think it would not look like that. My giver would not look like that. It would be, I don't know. And I wouldn't have Jeff Bridges in it.
Who were you picturing the guy in the cover?
Yeah, mostly or as close as I can get to that. Some kind of very super old ZZ Top guy. Let's check what they're doing first, I guess.
Yeah, naturally. Mm-hmm. I think I would also do black and white because I think the story kind of demands it because the reveal of color is so big. And when you realize that everyone else living in this world doesn't see color, like that's a huge moment in the book. And I mean, obviously the photos that have been released from the movie are in color, but that doesn't mean the movie's in color. The movie could just be in black and white up until a certain point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would definitely do it in black and white. And yeah, I would probably have an all white cast because I think the idea of races can't be in a world where they've chosen sameness.
Well, Hollywood is not going to fight you on that idea.
that's very true. And you know, like revealing colors little by little, sort of Pleasantville-esque.
Yeah.
And actually, the town, the way I see the town in my head is kind of, it's futuristic in that they have certain technologies that we don't have and they have certain, you know, medicines and whatever that we don't have. But the way I saw it the second time I read it was like almost like a very familiar, like 50s-esque town. Everything is like, I guess, like dirt roads is what I see. Everyone's always like – everything's kind of very natural but also at the same time, everything's very sterile. So there aren't too many like – it's a weird, you know, vision that I see in my head because they still have like a river that runs alongside their town.
Yeah.
So there is going to be some greenery near it, but it won't be green. Obviously, it'd be grayery near
their
town.
What about like a camp from the 50s? Is sort of, I guess, I was picturing. Like if everyone was going
like to like a log camp cabin
with cabins, it wouldn't have to be log, but it's like a retreat. The whole every family goes away, and they have these. Sort of 50s-style houses.
That's what I see, 50s-style, like, kind of bungalow houses. Yeah.
See, like, I kind of imagine more of, like, when you go to...
Tatooine?
When you go to, like, Disney World and you look at something like Tomorrowland or Epcot Center and what they thought the future was going to look like in the 60s and 70s, sort of a retro future look. Oh. That's sort of kind of how I imagined it. Mm. But with the issue of color, because when you get to the reveal... of you're seeing the color red and going like, oh shit. And then one of my first thoughts was, how are they going to do that in the movie? And I think the obvious answer is something like Pleasantville, where color gradually becomes introduced, you know, more and more. I almost think you'd have to do the opposite in order to give it any impact in a movie, which is that we are watching the movie as any other movie. And it isn't until the giver tells him, you're seeing you what you're seeing is color that we go, oh shit, no one here, this is not what they see.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's the only way that as the audience you have the same reaction you do reading the book of like, oh God, they don't see color. Because like, otherwise you're priming them for it.
If you never see anything in his POV and then like Jeff Bridges says, oh, you're seeing color, and immediately you snap to his POV, everything in black and white except for whatever is red. That'd be huge.
So I don't know. And then I think the only other challenge facing the film is the structure of the book works beautifully as a novel because it's the sensory details of the different memories and stuff he's experiencing, you know, all of that works really well. The fact that in terms of like there's no real momentum in terms of action until the very, very end, until they start planning the escape, that I think the challenge there is, I don't know, not sustaining interest, but like sustaining a level of tension and stuff throughout that first part of the story. I think it's totally possible. But on that note, here's something I just read today about changes that how the movie's going to be different than the book. This comes from Jeff Bridges himself. Just a few, but it's some of them are kind of...
So say the word man at the end of them, if Jeff Bridges is saying
that. Well, his exact quote here is that they're going to be taking a lot of liberties with the story. The big one, we already know that Jonas is going to be 16, not 12.
Mm. Right. I think that's... To me, his age is so important to the story that would have been like the one thing I was holding on to. It was like they have to be kids.
Especially because
to become young adults.
What I had said before about this being that really important moment in time where you're starting to go out on your own and figure out who you are as a person, as an individual, and individuality being such a big thing in the movie. And I think 12 is more reflective of that than 16 is a whole other big bag of issues you got going on. But like, you know what else was funny, what occurred to me reading the book too, is this is a typical message in kids' books and the importance of being an individual and celebrating what makes you different instead of being insecure about it. And da, 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 da. I had a instructor in college once say this, and this has always stuck with me because I'm not sure I really bought into it at the time. But the older I get, the more I think like, oh, he was kind of onto something there. He said that when you're a kid, the most important thing is like standing out, or like when you're a teenager, you want to have your own look. You want to have your own identity. You want attention. Mm-hmm. And then as you get older, when you become an adult, you kind of just want to assimilate. You kind of just want to not ruffle any feathers and just sort of fade into the background, and you don't want to call that much attention to yourself. Oh, this is what everybody else is wearing when we do this thing, so I better put on something similar. Like,
hey, what is everyone wearing to that party?
Yeah.
Are
we dressing up? Are we
overdressed or underdressed? Yeah.
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 So just, I mean, the whole concept of the book, you know, that's sort of, it's just so of that particular moment of, you know, of being 12. Another change they're making is that Meryl Streep is playing the chief elder. So she's going to have, I guess, a very expanded role in the film. And that there's going to be more of a romance between Jonas and Fiona, which I think is inevitable. It's a Hollywood movie. There's got to be have a romance angle in it.
But how is it possible?
I know.
That means that Fiona is off her meds too then. Or else, you know, she's got the stirrings.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe he's like, hey, don't take your drugs today.
Don't take your drugs.
Don't take those drugs.
He's the best peer pressurer.
I think, he's
don't
pretty
do
good
drugs.
At that. Hey,
but like, so drugs. I saw those photos too that they released, and it doesn't look like what I had imagined either. I don't hate the idea of, of Jeff Bridges as the giver.
I don't either.
I think that's fine. And
he's at that point in his career too where he can play wise old man.
Except that I think even in the book it alludes to the fact that the giver is not that old.
Like, right, but that the idea of the memories have aged him.
Sure, yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. Just the whole grizzle. Yeah, absolutely. I think he'll be great. And the fact that he's been trying to make this for
20 years.
Yeah, so obviously it means something to him. He wants to get it right.
When he first wanted to make it, he wanted his father to be the giver.
Oh my gosh.
He wanted Lloyd Bridges to be the giver 20 years ago.
Oof,
and now, if you look at, I did a Google search of Lloyd Bridges, because when I mentioned it to somebody, like, I know who that is, but I don't know who it is. Showed him the picture, and the first picture that comes up is him with a beard in like a black suit. He must have done some kind of period piece film. And then I saw the picture of Jeff Bridges that they just released. They look identical. It's insane. He looks just like his father.
Well, so I had the same reaction to the photos too, which is just like, oh, wow, that's not how I pictured any of this. But I expected
that's
that.
Gonna
I think that's, yeah, that's going to be inevitable.
They look like Amish. I feel like it's like an
yeah,
Amish
totally.
Tone.
Yeah.
The Giver especially looks, yeah. looks like Colonel Sanders a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The costuming at least.
But then he has the baby sling is a absolutely like modern day baby thing. I pictured him wrapped in like
it says baby Bjorn on it
cloth. Yeah, he's got a baby Bjorn. That's a baby thing.
The idea that he's 16 is just,
well, you know, this is weird. That makes me think about if you going back to the setting, how everything would look. I was just having this conversation with my dad about this movie because my dad's into a lot of like sci-fi stuff, and I was telling him. He should go see this movie, Her, that just came out. And I was saying one of the things I really liked about it was the way it depicts the future is like it's something you don't see a lot, which is that it doesn't go overboard with it because we are still surrounded by things right now that are 20, 30, 40 years old. Like it, they don't – the change isn't that dramatic. And that's something that that movie really nails is that it's futuristic enough but it all makes sense. It's not like a whole – it's not something unrecognizable. And
Looper was the same way. Whereas like the city was still the city. It was dirtier because, you know, the future. But there were a lot of cars from like right now that were like retrofitted to use, I guess, gas or whatever.
Right.
To use whatever.
But so I'm thinking that like when you take away memories and when you take away like the, you know, experiences and we're not passing that stuff down – culturally, you know, there isn't a lot of innovation in terms of...
Right, that's what I was saying earlier.
Yeah.
The society won't progress.
Uh-uh.
It stagnates.
It's the same. The toaster you have is the toaster you'll always have, and there's someone who can fix it because they know how to fix that toaster
right.
forever.
Right.
So, final thoughts on The Giver.
I thought it was a real cool... thing to read again, and I think a lot of it, a lot of the themes that are brought up in this book are themes that I ended up really loving and really exploring more as I became more of a young adult, more of a reader, questioning the world that I live in. And those themes are some of my favorites in Fahrenheit 451, which is my favorite book. There's a lot of that.
A ton of crossover.
You live in houses that look like every other house, and if you're different, we'll burn you. And, you know, I mean, they don't, but it's sort of a similar future utopia that really turns out to not be good at all. So this was I think this is amazing that that we were able to read this book as young people to have these interesting ideas, these thought-provoking ideas at such a young age. You really start to consider, like you said, you know, the choices that you're able to make or the memories that you get from people around you, the affection that you feel for people around you. It was a great thing to reread.
Carlos?
So this is one of my favorite books. And you know, it's the first book. just the ideas that it, you know, the questions that it asks the reader, you know, would you be willing to get rid of everything? You know, you have to get rid of the good as well as the bad if you want to live completely safe. That's the first time I'd ever been asked those questions before. And, I think that we live in a world where we are always giving up good things to get rid of bad things. And, you know, that's just kind of the nature of society. But this book, I think, was a good warning for our generation. Like, don't give up too much because you could end up in a world that you don't recognize anymore and that isn't better than the one you're in.
Yeah.
I love the writing, especially for a children's book, the writing of it, the way that exposition is kind of given out over time and not, you know, not in your face and, you know, like everything everything that is about, you know, strange about this world is revealed to you in the same way that the color is. It's so, like, you're just like, everything is kind of matter of fact, like, oh yeah. And by the way, old people live in the house of the old, you know, like that's where they go after school. They go to the house of the old. And so you're just kind of like left to kind of build this world on your own, which I think is what I loved about it as a kid. Cause I loved the idea of like world building as a kid. Cause I have a God complex. but yeah, this is always going to be one of my favorite books. And, I'm glad we talked about it before the movie came out, before Too Many Photos came out. Because I didn't want to be tainted by whatever, you know, this movie might be amazing, but I didn't want, I wanted this to be different than my experience with the film.
Right.
Yeah. Mm.
I don't know how much of this plays into the book or not, but I know that Lois Lowry lost a son. And so I know she's talked about, you know, processing that grief and how, you know, some of her books have helped her sort of work through all that. I don't know if The Giver specifically is one of them. But to me, it would make a lot of sense of like just realizing, because I think that's it. You know, whenever something hits really hard like that, there is a, you know, a tendency to sort of wish you felt nothing and just, you know, whatever caused this pain. Maybe sometimes thinking like, I'd be better off if it had never even existed. And this sort of being her way of reconciling the fact that, like, no, whatever I'm feeling, I'm supposed to feel. And this is just, this is part of life. And this is what you have to do. And I see the book as sort of a response to those feelings. I think it's like, it's a really good quick read. I think as an adult, some of it is a little heavy-handed and obvious, but I mean, it's for kids. And right. So you can forgive it of that. I said before, I think 12 is right around the age where you're starting to forge your own identity and when these themes will probably resonate with you the most. All right, guys, that's it for us. Rate and review us on iTunes, like our Facebook page to find out what we're looking at next and to share your own memories of this stuff. Let us know if you have suggestions for other titles we should revisit, and we'll see you next time.